Welcome to Ballsy, the podcast where I interview successful artists and creators on how they got the balls to sell their art and turn their practice into a profitable business. As a former entrepreneur turned artist, I realized that being an artist is basically like running a small startup, and you, the artist, are the CEO. I talk to artists about their businesses, talk real numbers, growth hacks, tools and tricks, and how they were ballsy enough to make that their career. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to Ballsy. Today, the person who had the balls to sell some art. How do I pronounce it correctly? Joachim?
Joachim.
Joachim.
Right.
Fantastic. So, Joachim, let's get started. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and a little bit about your art, just so we have some context for the interview, and then we'll jump right in.
Okay, good. First of all, thank you for having me. I think it's wonderful to reach out and connect with artists all over the world. So I'm Joachim Rotteveel. I live in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. That's not Denmark, in case anyone is wondering. Rotterdam is like a 45-minute train ride from Amsterdam away. If you ever visit the Netherlands, you should definitely check out Rotterdam. And I have been working as an artist for 12 or 13 years now. I do have a studio here in Rotterdam, and I did a lot of residencies all over the world, which I'm very privileged to do. I started out in art school with duct tape because I really wanted to paint, actually, but I never got my hands around paint. So I was looking for materials that I could work with. So I added with duct tape. And I think it was like 5 or 6 years ago, and I reached a point where I couldn't really explore the material anymore that I wanted to explore. So I gave myself a year off. I canceled all the exhibitions that I was planning to do. And I just went freestyling in my studio. And then after a year, I ended up working with foil instead, adhesive foil, which is similar to duct tape, but I didn't know that at the time. It was just like a natural route, and I ended up with sticky stuff again. So the adhesive foil, it's 45 centimeters wide, 60 centimeters wide, 90 centimeters wide, and it's long as meters, as long as you want. And I make pieces, apply adhesive foil on debond panels, so like large aluminium panels, or I apply it directly onto the wall. So I make these murals, and my starting point is always using material as a way to paint, really. So I look at the paint. Yeah.
Your work has like a very interesting sculptural, yet like when I first saw your work, I didn't know whether it was paint, whether it was like actually foil would have been the last thing I would have guessed. Like I couldn't tell whether like the material or you creating kind of the sculptural lines and the painting. It's really fascinating work. Very geometric, very bright, like really good color contrast, really good color study. And I was particularly drawn to it, that the scale, which is one of the reasons I found you via Instagram. Speaking of which, make sure that your Instagram is so we can, if people are listening, they can look to see what we're talking about. I'll also post some pieces as well in the notes. Your Instagram is just your name, correct?
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Joachim Rotteveel.
Check the spelling on the thing because it's not as intuitive as it looks. You've done this kind of unusual materials. I have to go back and try to track down some of your old work. I didn't realize the duct tape stuff. I like the fact that you've like evolved in like sticky tape like materials. That's super interesting. What did you do? So obviously the context of this is that like at some point you had the courage to sell art. So we're going to go backwards. So before you sold up, what did you do before you were an artist?
I studied communications. That was actually, I wanted to go into media. So I studied communications, worked in agencies, in TV. But after 3 or 4 years, that wasn't enough for me. And I've always been very creative since I was a child. I could hold a pencil, I would draw. So I wanted to explore my creativity, and I applied for art school. And so that's when I ended up doing art school, when I was like 28, a bit later than the usual school.
Okay.
But that's when they enrolled me into art school. And I think it was around 2009 or so that I graduated. And during graduation, at the graduation show, I met two gallery owners from Rotterdam, and they were extremely nice. And they saw that the pieces that I was making weren't sellable at all, because they were like duct tape on cardboard, and you would have to hammer them into the wall with nails. And they would ask me all kinds of questions, like, how do you expect people to hang this in their homes? And I said, I don't care. I just want to make this stuff. And they thought it was interesting anyway. So they asked me for the gallery. They invited me to the gallery. And that's when I started working with the gallery. But my intention was never really to make art that would sell. I always thought that as long as I make art that is interesting to me, then I don't care if people buy it or not. I have my daytime job, which is still in communications. So I would make a living. And then I thought, I'll just make what I want to make. And
okay. Yeah. So your intention was to just keep your day job going and be creative on the side.
Yeah, actually, I was at one point I was working 3 days a week, and I was doing like the art practice the other days and the other time. And I was really spending a lot of time in my studio, and I would get really annoyed when the daytime job was actually pushing away the art. But yeah, you have to make a living, right?
So hold on, I have two questions for you.
Yeah.
Technically speaking, the first art you actually sold was a gallery taking your work.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's like super rare. Most people like struggle and fight their entire existence to like eventually get a gallery to rep them and then sell. You basically came out of our school. The gallery is like, yeah, we'll take that. Yeah. And so you're like, that's really cool.
It seems I would have never imagined. No, really, because I thought like I was making these large murals with all kinds of construction materials, large plastic foils, duct tape, and it was insane. And I just wanted to make it because I thought it was something new I had never seen before. At least I didn't know any artists that would really use that kind of material. So I thought I'll just start doing this and then I'll see where it ends up. Yeah.
Okay. So now you have basically come out of our school and you've sold nothing except you have gallery representation. So yeah. You're in the gallery. So I'm going to make the assumption that we're going to ask that the trajectory of your career was very gallery driven.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And the good thing was because the gallery I started with in Rotterdam, they were extremely nice and thoughtful. And they said, you know what, you make such exceptional work that people will need another 8 years to get used to this. But we don't care. We really believe in your work. So we'll gladly include you in the team. And they said 20% of the gallery artists are actually making 80% of the profit for the entire gallery. Well, so they said, we don't care if you don't make money at first, you'll come in time. Just continue developing your work and just follow your own path. And then eventually it will become sellable. They were right.
And at what point, how long did it take you before you were generating, that they were generating enough work and you were selling enough work where you're like, I could give up, where the day job was then encroaching too much on the art, you decided to give up the day job?
I think just 2 or 3 years ago, it was just before the pandemic started. Yeah. And it was just before the pandemic started and my work suddenly started to pick up. There were these art collectors mentioning my name everywhere in the media also. So I was really at a point where I thought this is never going to fly. And I, unfortunately, the two gallery owners from my first gallery in Rotterdam, they had deceased and they had a car incident. So unfortunately, they had deceased. I had switched to a gallery in Amsterdam. They had the same philosophy. They said, you just create your work, because I had a lot of exhibitions going on. And they said, we believe in you. You just continue going on like this. Eventually, we hope that you will sell. So I would maybe sell 2 or 3 pieces per year. And they were still happy with it. They said, you make nice stuff, just keep going. And so I think only 2 or 3 years ago, it started picking up. And now it is selling. But yeah.
So I got a couple of questions. So you're making work this whole time. You must be building up a good amount of inventory that's filling up the studio. And...
And I was so anxious to get rid of it because I would sometimes just hand out pieces to friends because I would have like tons of work in my studio. I would sometimes take the work off and then use it again. Yeah. But now that's not the case anymore. Thank God.
Yeah. So was there a particular moment that like, or it just organically happened, or was it the change of material, or was it like press or Instagram? What was the, do you know, or do you think that there was something that caused that inflection point?
Yeah, I think the change of material into adhesive foil, it definitely changed the character of my work. And I think that I got a bit more grown up or mature, if you like. And I think I really believe in working with one gallery only because people know who you are, know where they can get your work. People really have to get used to your work, to my work at least. I think it takes a long, long time before people start really believing in my work at least, because I thought foil, that's so flimsy and you can crash it. Do we really take the risk, even though it's not that expensive? So yeah, I think people saw it as a risk. And I think 3 years ago, I think maybe I had been around long enough for people to have confidence in that taking that risk might be worth it. And I think, yeah, my work may have been evolved to a certain point where also I was invited by galleries from abroad. And now also I work with the gallery in Madrid. And so maybe it's zeitgeist. I don't know. Maybe people needed color in their life. I don't know. All of a sudden, like it, all the arrows were in the right direction, it seems. And yeah, and some press helped. Also algorithms in Instagram help as well. So yeah.
I usually start, I try to like get a framework of an artist. Like I start with the revenue side and the sales stuff and then the cost and different artists. And I talk to an artist that some that are only gallery represented, some that do everything, some that are, you know, just own their own business and are Instagram artists or TikTok artists. And so it's so interesting to see the different, the way people like go about it. So the, like we described, the work you made comes in obviously a variety of different sizes and colors. You do from very small pieces all the way up to installations. What price point wise, just so people have like a point of reference in terms of the framework of where it lands.
It starts with 500 euros for small pieces, like 20 by 20 centimeters. That's 550. And it goes all the way up to 8,000-10,000 euros if you require the larger panels or large installations. So yeah, that's like the price range.
Very cool. And so your work is interesting in the sense that it doesn't lend itself. Do you sell only art or do you have like kind of other verticals? Do you do prints or things like that? Do you photograph your work and sell it? Or no, it's just a small piece or a big piece.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And like, how prolific are you? Like how many pieces are you making?
Right now we're up to, I think, 50 pieces this year, 5-0. Okay. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah.
So yeah, piece a week.
I think that all in all, we had an exhibition this year, February, March, that was extremely successful in terms of sales and also in terms of media coverage. So yeah, but still like me talking about this now, it seems so awkward because I was used to an entirely different practice up until two years ago. So it's like, yeah, the gallery also mentioned like, yeah, you're our number one selling artist right now. And I'm like, really? Yeah. Am I hearing this right? So if there's any artist right now listening, if you're not selling, it doesn't mean that you're never going to sell, because just believe in yourself and believe in the work that you're making, because in the end, if it comes from a genuine drive and motivation and also artistic quality, then it will definitely find buyers. I'm sure of that.
Yeah. And once again, it's working in the abyss, right? Like you're working constantly and you believe that what you're making is cool and you think it looks amazing. And you're like, and as artists, you're like, we can't be that wrong, right? Other people have to like it also. And when we see that, but what's nice to see in like a career like yours and a bunch of people I talk to is like, when that inflection plate takes place, like you go from like 0 to 100. And did it feel like it was happening quickly, or did it feel like when it happened that it was just like overnight?
It was, I think, the first time I realized that I was going to sell seriously. That was 2020, and right before the pandemic started. My gallery owner in Amsterdam, Merel, she sent me a text indicating one red dot in the exhibition. I thought, oh wow, I sold a piece. Well, good for us. And then 5 minutes later, she sold another red dot. She sent another red dot. And then after, she said another red dot. So I called her, I said, what's going on? And she said, you sold three pieces. I said, really? That's my annual revenue, right? And she said, yeah, so we're done for the year. And I thought that was really funny. But then it really started selling. So that was amazing. And then the pandemic hit. And I think because I had two exhibitions right then, which were stalled and then eventually got extended, we had a lot of attention on Instagram. We made these online videos from the exhibition because no one was allowed to leave their place, their home. So we thought we might as well bring the exhibition to people in their houses through Instagram. And then I said to my gallery owner, why not make a limited edition series for this type of year, the pandemic, everyone's at home looking at their bare walls. I said, why don't we make a nice limited edition, like smaller sizes? And that sold like in an hour. And then I thought, wow, we have something here. But stupid thing, it's really like, it's a big compliment, right? When people buy your work. On the other hand, it should never really be the main goal or the, like, I sometimes know which color combinations work or which format works, or, and I don't want that to lead me into my artistic process. So you have to really shut off the voices in your head that say, why don't you use a bit of this or that? It's just, no, I want to make what I want to make. And that's like the most important thing.
That's an interesting question. So like when you see like a color combination for something selling, you don't necessarily lean into that, even though you're like, oh, obviously this works. You keep trying to follow the direction of your, of where the art takes you, not where the sales take you.
Yeah, exactly. I only create work. I only make work where like the color combination or the color or the material actually teaches me something new. And of course, like the lesson in each work is sometimes different and sometimes it's smaller or a bigger lesson. But I always want to learn something new. If I don't learn anything from a work, then I think it sucks, because if I'm not interested in the work, then why should anyone else be? So then I take it off and start anew.
Interesting. So you said that obviously it helped when COVID happened. So do you get a lot of, what percentage of, actually, because you're so gallery driven, like how do you deal with it? Do you ever get inbound traffic through Instagram or social channels, and do you then defer them to the gallery? Do you deal with those people directly? Like how do you go about approaching that?
I always approach people directly, and then I refer them to the gallery. So if people send me a DM, I thank them for their interest, and I say, this is the artist page from the gallery. If you're interested, have a look. People are always welcome to visit my studio if they're around, but I never sell from my studio, because two things. I think like with my gallery, it's a 50-50 division, right? So they get 50%, I get 50%. If people are, sometimes people are in my studio and they want to buy the pieces of my studio, and they say, why don't you give me a 40% discount, because you're going to make more anyway. And I think that's not the case, right? Because then you're actually spoiling your own market and your own market price. Just to be clear, I always tell people, this is the price. And I, of course, if you buy more, then you can make a 5 or 10% discount. But I always refer them to the gallery, because it's no use. And this, and the second thing is, they've been around. We've been working together for 10 years now, and they've supported me also throughout the slow years. And they took me to these fairs in Berlin, which cost a lot of money, and I didn't sell anything. And they were just like, no, you're making brilliant work. Keep going, and we believe in you. So it feels so stupid to actually take their money after such a long time. So I feel it's only logical to be loyal to each other.
That's, I understand it and respect it. Do you now, in terms of like pricing, do you discuss pricing with the gallery? Do they set it? Do you set it? Do you come up together and set it?
I think when pieces started to sell really quickly, we looked at the pricing and we thought maybe we could increase it, I think by 10% or so. And then you look at the pricing, and then I always like these psychological prices where you think 5-10 is maybe, 4.95 is better. People will probably buy a piece for 4.95 instead of 5.10. So you look at the psychological pricing. So it goes back and forth, but it's difficult because it's not oil paint. Because in the Netherlands, I'm not sure if that system is international or universal, but in the Netherlands, we have this rating system where you take the width and the height of a piece. And you say, for instance, if you have a piece 80 by 100, you say the price is 80 plus 100, it's 180. And then you have a factor of 12 or 14 or 16 that multiplies with that amount. And then you get your price. And if you are a very popular artist, then the rating or the ranking goes up, right? So then you have a factor of 20 or a factor of 30 or a multiplier that actually multiplies the size of the work. But that goes for oil or acrylic painters, and not really for people with slightly less expensive material like myself. So we always look like, how does that feel? Like, how does the price feel? Does it feel right? If you compare it to other painters or other artists, it's like a gut feeling also, I think.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of people who price to keep myself relatively sane. Like I price often on a square foot basis, just so I have a point of reference for myself. That like, so I know when I do a gigantic piece versus a small piece, sometimes I charge like a slightly higher one for smaller square footage, just because otherwise I don't hit the numbers I need to hit. And if you do math at like really big scale, that the numbers just get, but it's also crazy. The courage, but it's also the courage to ask it's also the courage and just the fact that people are willing to pay these things for your work. I always find it's very rewarding. Like, I think it's like the most amazing feeling in the world.
It is. It is. Maybe it's stupid to say that, but I always think if people really want to buy the piece, I think, really? I would not necessarily give it away for free, but it sometimes feels that way, especially when these people then, I don't know, like you, I always get the feeling that, yeah, I mean, would people really spend money on my work? It still feels a bit awkward sometimes. Yeah. But then again, I guess it's also, you get used to it. And that's also why I like working with the gallery, because they take over that salesman.
They keep it separate. Right. Exactly. There's something about the separation between artist and purchaser that is. Now, so you have one main gallery, but is that globally, or do you have different galleries for different geographic regions?
Actually, I work with the gallery in Amsterdam, Gallery Bart. We have an agreement that within Amsterdam, they are the main gallery, so they have exclusive rights. Outside of Amsterdam, I am free to do what I want, but always in correspondence with them. So I always take them into account. I think that's only fair. I don't necessarily believe in a lot of touch points or points of sales, because people get confused. And you don't really want to, or at least in the Netherlands, you also have to keep it a bit scarce, if you understand what I mean. Like, you don't really want to flood the market with your work and with all these points of sales, and then people may get bored or annoyed another. So that's why I only work in the Netherlands. And then in Spain, I work with Garna Art Gallery, and they are located in Madrid. And I sometimes get requests from other galleries, but pretty critical because a context of the gallery and the context of the other work is really critical for the perception and the appreciation of my work. Because sometimes people think that it's a gimmick and it's a joke, my work, because I work with foil, and they think I'm being cynical or taking the art world not too serious. And that's why I'm very serious, because I've heard this before. Like, people would be like, yeah, but your work's a joke, right? Because you work with foil, and who does that? So I try to be very critical as to, is the gallery really serious? What other stuff do they sell? Yeah, basically
don't listen to the haters, man. Like, your work is cool. don't do it.
Do you get that a lot?
Something I get, yeah, sure. The internet's full of trolls, right? That's an opinion. If I listened, I'd be curled up in a little ball. Yeah. My work doesn't come to the acclaim of yours, so it's... Screw them. Now, do you ever use like online galleries at all? Do you do like the Saatchis or the Raten Arts or the First Dibs, or are there other channels? Because you have like a very limited set of channels in terms of distribution.
Yeah, my gallery in Amsterdam puts my work on this online channel called Gallery Viewer. But
okay.
But if you are interested in the piece, then you have to contact the gallery anyway. So I'm not really sure if it's an online channel or just another promotional tool. But no, I don't use any online galleries. The funny thing, I would never buy a piece online. I would really want to see it, but that's just old fashioned me. I've had clients from Singapore, Denmark, Germany, who ordered work online through the gallery. And I guess it's common use.
So let's go to like production and cost and things you spend, like kind of the cost side of the business, thing you spend money on. You say it's foil. Foil is probably delicate in some respects. How do you, in terms of fabrication, in terms of shipping and things like that, like how does it hold? Are you nervous about do things get destroyed?
Oh, yeah. Occasion. Yeah, yeah. Because people don't really know what kind of material they're looking at, they squeeze the foil, they pinch the foil. That's just, like, we have this letter now, this side letter being sent or shipped with the piece, saying you have to treat the work in this way. This is not how you treat it. This is when it becomes very fragile, la, 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 la. So we give a lot of information about it. The gallery actually does a great job in boxing and shipping, and so I'm never really nervous. However, I recently shipped one piece myself to Madrid, and then when I see the pictures, I think, yeah, it holds up, but I'm not sure. It's very delicate. So we are now looking into presenting the pieces in these large glass boxes where you can actually ship them and also, you know, present them in your homes in a safer way. It's really beyond me why anyone would actually pinch or pluck on a piece of art. It's insane. And still, I have two or three times a year, I get this request from people saying, I'm sorry, but the maid pinched the work. Can you do something about it? And
it's always the maid, I'm sure.
It's never really the maid, right? That's so stupid.
Curiosity did kill the cat for sure. Yeah. Do you have a team of, obviously you get a ton of support from the gallery. So it's almost like that's clearly your team. And so that's like a support staff. Do you have any like direct studio support staff or studio assistants, that type of stuff?
No, I don't have assistants. I've been working the last year with a colorist colleague of mine, Thomas Vermeer, and we've been doing shows together and projects together. And actually it started off as, not as a joke, but it started off as let's try and do something together because we met, we got started talking about colors, and he actually has another line of business. He comes from the fashion industry, but he really dig my work and I really dig his work. So we said, why don't we start like a small collaboration, maybe do 5 or 8 pieces together and see where it goes. And then all of a sudden we were doing like 50 pieces together, and it was really successful. We've been working together for a year now on projects. And it's really rewarding to have someone in the studio who you can chat with, have a sparring partner, because he can really look more critical to the entire process, but also the professional side of business. And he has different ideas. He has different networks. I think, yeah, like collaborating with other professionals. I collaborated last year with 2 fashion designers, Elliot Collective, and brilliant girls in the Netherlands who make wonderful work. And we did these wonderful or extremely large installations where fashion and murals came together. It gives you new energy and it gives you new ideas, and it takes you out of the rut that you sometimes get into. So I don't have an assistant, but I do have these collaborations that, yeah.
So, right. It's in many respects, they're better, right? Like an assistant, like takes direction, like having some, like you said, I think a sparring partner, like someone to challenge you intellectually about the direction of work or color or, yeah, or the statement it's trying to make. I think that's so many of us like work like in these, we're alone, right? Like you sit in your studio, yeah, by yourself making stuff. And I think that looks right. Like, so to have that second voice, I can see. Now with the fashion one, did you actually put that, like your style of work in terms of like color and tech, like I could, cause it does, your work does feel like creased fabric in many respects. Was, yeah, it actually on physical clothing or was it just like an installation around the clothing?
The one with the Elliot Collective, that was an installation where we made, like I would start for instance with the sketches for murals and I would present them the sketches and they would say, oh, that's interesting. Like you are trying to do this or that. Let's see if we can actually incorporate that in a textile piece or a fashion piece. And then we would see how we would actually intertwine the two. So they would, for instance, make a large fashion piece that I would apply to the floor and then from the floor go all the way to the wall and then create this enormous mural. And then, you know, we would have this piece of fashion inside the mural installation. And then they said, let's invite performers to do a performance in this, whatever setting it is. Yeah, that was amazing. That was such a brilliant experience for both of us because you see your works being taken to a next level or another industry, another dimension really. And
it also provides so many new eyeballs, like a different, yeah, audience, and different people to come look and to come see.
Absolutely.
Now, when you get these collaborations, are these people who like knock on your door? Are they brought by the gallery?
The gallery asked me 2 years ago, why don't you think of collaborating with someone else? It might be anyone because they have this program where they would invite artists to collaborate. And then I said, I've always wanted to do something with fashion. Why don't I look for fashion designers? And then they said, we know these young fashion designers straight from uni. So why don't you have a look around? They had a short list of 5 or 6 of them. And I said, I like these 2. I don't really know who they are, but I like the work that they're making. And it turned out that they had already started collaborating between the 2 of them. And so that was coincidence, but that was how the collaboration came about. And they're 25 and I'm 46, right? So it felt a mentorship. But I didn't need to tell them anything. Like at one point they were giving me directions in terms of color and fabric and stuff. So that was really insane. And the other collaboration with Thomas Vermeer, I wanted to introduce him to the gallery because I thought we had been talking about color and other projects. And I thought, why don't I ask him as a curator for the gallery? Because then he could do something around the color theme and then maybe create this entire style chamber around one particular color and then invite artists. So I saw all these opportunities for him and we started talking. And then I thought, yeah, sure, I'm going to introduce him to the gallery, but I want to also make work with him because this is so interesting. He had all these different points of view on color and on the foil that I was working with. Yeah, so that's basically how it comes about. Like just be curious and see where it can take you.
Now, are there, in terms of the financial components of that, like when you guys are doing a collab and that sells, that's one thing. Like when people come to you though, do people come to you with a budget or do you kind of figure it out or wing it?
I think 2 years ago here in the Netherlands, they came up with, I'm not sure how you call it in English, but they come up with a program where they would actually reward artists according to the type of exhibition that you were invited to. So let's say you have an exhibition where you hang one piece on a wall, then boom, that's €500 participation fee. And if you are asked to do a larger piece, then you get more. So there's this rewarding system now. If we do other projects, for instance, Thomas and I did a project with Stephanie Jansen, a singer here in the Netherlands, and she asked us to create an artistic world for her and a visual world, and then also do fashion styling and create a mural piece for the artwork for her album. And so we just looked at the amount of hours that we would spend in as you put into it. And then also because we know her, she's a friend of ours, so we had to make it like budget friendly proposal. Yeah. So I look at the amount of hours that go into it. Then I also look at the artistic value of the project. And I think what also matters is the market that you're into, because the Dutch market, and that's very interesting, I think, people here in the Netherlands tend to buy small pieces of art. So it's 500, €700, that's max for a lot of people. Whereas in Madrid, I started working with the gallery 2 years ago and I sent all these smaller pieces to them because I thought that's going to sell, right? And they said, thank you very much. But here in Madrid, people like large art. We don't really care about the smaller pieces. Why don't you come over and make these large panels instead? And I thought, okay, thank you for having me. So I went there last year, did a fair with them, and I made these extremely large panels, like a three, and they sold it. And I was just amazed. And they sold it to a collector from Lisbon. It was like large pieces, 2 meters high, and he didn't care. He thought this is nice work and let's just buy the three of them. So
now it's for something like that, like you said, was it easier for you to travel and fabricate there than it was to fabricate in your studio and then ship?
I
have a question for you because you work with like really interesting detailed color. Do you work with the foil maker to make custom colors or do you have
that would be like a next step. Right now I can choose from I think up until 100 colors or so. And then you also have these transparent foils. I'm always looking, if I don't really get the color that I want, then I can add the transparent foils and see if I can end or mix them. But it's a bit like, it's a tricky situation because I started working with duct tape and then foil because the material really limits me. And I work really well in confined situations. So I need a sort of limitation in order to go in deep. So if I have full freedom to choose whatever color I want, then I don't know, like my head will explode probably because then like the options are limitless. And that's something that I sometimes struggle with. So I'd rather have these limitations for now. And maybe at one point I can take the freedom and then ask if they can develop something for me. But right now it's limited.
I think they call that the paradox of choice.
Oh, really?
It's a phrase, right. It's often they say some of the better designs and best designs come from the limitations, right? When you can only use X or Y, and when you have too much choice, like when it's blue sky and it's infinite, it's often harder to create things that are interesting because there's just too much going on.
Yeah. I can definitely relate to that.
Now, I assume like you must be this foil company's very good customer. Do you get do you just buy reams and reams of this stuff? So you just have like different sizes, different shapes, different everything?
Yeah. So I get really excited when I see a new color. And at one point, because this type of foil is usually used in interior. So in,
what are they used for?
Yeah, in the interior industry, in kitchens, for instance, when you want to redecorate your kitchen cabinets and you don't really want to buy new ones, then you apply the foil to your kitchen cabinets and you have a new color. Or you can apply the foil to your car. It's called car wrapping, and it's extremely. Yeah, so you have these cool cars driving by with all these rainbow shiny colors, and it's basically foil. And so that's what you use it.
Do you use the shrink component of it as well? Because that stuff all shrinks as well, no?
Exactly. I don't use any hair dryer or shrink components because for my work, that's not really relevant. Like I can just use my both hands and that's enough. But I know that, for instance, when you want to shrink it, then you need a heating system or a heater to actually make it shrink. Yeah. So it's because a lot of people in the Netherlands use it for their kitchen cabinets. At one point, one of the shops actually called me in and said, "What do you need all this foil for? Are you doing all this interior project?" They thought I was redecorating the thousands of kitchen cabinets. I said, "No, I'm an artist." And they were like, "Oh yeah, so these artists, right? They use the stupidest stuff to make their work." So yeah, I think I'm one of the few, I think, to use foil.
Yeah. Because I didn't realize that was the foil it was. There must be an infinite amount of colors because I've seen cars and all these like weird, and they have like weird changing tints and patterns. Like, super interesting. All right, now it all clicked. Like, these are questions I probably should have asked at the beginning, but now that they come to me. Hold on, sorry, I'm checking my notes. So in terms of, I would assume yours is pretty high. So I always ask, what's the percentage of time that you spend between making art versus all the things it takes you to make the art?
Oh yeah, all the side stuff. Yeah, it's because you're a one-man band, right? So like you have to do everything. On a happy day, I get to work like maybe 4 hours on the actual work and then have 3 or 4 hours spending on PR, administration, boxing, like the ordering stuff, answering emails. So I think maybe 60-40. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think yours would be high just because the gallery takes a lot of If I get to 30% doing art, it's a miracle. Like between social and website management and the shipping and I dream of the day I can get to 50%.
And it's sometimes it's so frustrating because we make art because we want to make art, right? It's like it's a necessity. It's an internal motivation. And so when you feel the motivation and you get to your studio and you have all these other things bothering you before you get to do art, I share my space with a mate and he's great. But sometimes he's chatty and we drink coffee or he distracts me and I get really cranky because I think I really want to make art right now. So it's, I don't know. It can be frustrating.
Yeah, for sure. I used to do all the crappy work first. Now in my most recent practice, I try to do my creative work first thing in the morning now when I'm still have those juices flowing.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't always work so good. Now you start to do some really big stuff and kind of really big, cool installations. Like what's the largest thing that you've
I think 11 or 12 meters wide and 4 meters high.
Meters.
Yeah and I think we also did a piece not in February we did a piece which was like 5 or 6 meters high and 4 meters wide, so that's about it, but we can or I can make it as big as needs to be.
And when you do the like for those, are those permanent? Those are temporary.
They can be permanent, but usually they're temporary. And that's also the concept is because when I was in art school and I was starting to work with duct tape, the teacher said to me, "You know what? The highest aim for artists is to make long lasting or everlasting pieces of art that would last you for like centuries." And I've always been very annoyed by that statement because I feel that great art is art that is that comes from a place where someone is fascinated about something, and like you need to be able to work with the material that you need to work with, right? So I started to create these murals where I would actually fight that long lasting or everlasting character. And I would actually demonstrate that, you know, art can also be very temporary, and I would take it off and then the image would still be in your head instead of on the wall. It came about from this point of view where I thought, no, art should not only be about long lasting. So and then sometimes people say, I really want you to make a mural that will hold for at least like 10 or 20 years. And of course I can do that. So then I apply little nails and extra tape so that it will not peel off. But usually when the walls are in good condition and the foil is right, then it can last a lifetime, really. Yeah.
Kitchen cabinets last a lifetime. Cars last for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. It's strong.
Yeah. Correct. It's delicate when you hold it, but strong once it hits the wall.
Exactly.
One of the things I try to ask everybody is dealing with like successes and mistakes. What was like the biggest mistake or regret like that you wish that you could do? And then on the other side, what was like your most like crowning pride achievement that you think really helped the career move to the up?
To start with the latter, I think 3 years ago, the gallery asked me to do a large installation for a festival called Big Art, where you only have these extra large pieces. And I did an installation there. And at first I was a bit reluctant because I didn't know the affair well. And I thought that I had miscalculated the effect or the impact from the art fair. So once I made the piece, and I'm still very proud about that piece, I got a lot of good acclaim or credit or a lot of compliments. A lot of came from it. I think a lot of people saw it. It was in a good location. And so it really, I think that sort of helped spin or spiral the work, like the increase that came after it. So I think that sort of helped rocket the sales and the awareness. So that was good. And actually it was my gallery's decision. Like I said, yes, but they were the ones that actually enrolled me into that art fair.
Doing really large scale work that gives. I don't know what it is, but like super large scale work gives like credibility. I don't know if it's the fact that you can pull it off. I don't know if it's the fact that it's so big, like it changes, like breaks people's brains. But like there's something about scale that I agree. Once you do a big project, everyone's like, oh, that's the guy, right?
Yeah, that's really funny. Yeah, that's
I'm
true.
Working on a giant installation now that I'm like waiting for parts for. So it's I hope it has the same effect.
Oh, cool, cool. I'm following you now. So I'm probably about to see it.
Yeah.
No, and I think my biggest mistakes are usually when I feel, I don't know really how to describe it in short, but I always feel very responsible when I'm doing an exhibition somewhere. So whenever a curator then says, oh, change of plans, we need a bigger piece, the mural needs to be bigger, or I'm sorry, I gave the wall away to someone else and now you have this wall, or these last minute changes. Up until 2 or 3 years ago, I would accommodate and then I would say, oh, sure, I can solve your problem. And that didn't do my work good in terms of you have to be very critical to the end result. So I really learned from those mistakes. Like whenever a curator or a project manager or whoever is in charge of the exhibition has a problem, that's not necessarily for you to solve, right? You have to be responsible for the result, the end result of your work and the quality that you feel your work has to have. So I think I've made mistakes in recent or in earlier years where I would diminish the quality of the work, also because maybe like conditions were crappy, like the walls weren't as good to hold the foil, and I would do whatever to keep the foil hanging from the wall. And it gives me stress, and stress is never good when you're creating large pieces of work. Yeah, so I think 2 or 3 years ago I realized that. But it's also like a process, right?
Yeah, it's funny. That's the interesting part about mistakes, right? I'm a big believer in failing forward, right? Like those mistakes turn into solutions, right? Those mistakes turn into different ways to change your thought pattern. I always say some of my best work was my biggest mistakes. Like I was trying to do something else, screwed it up, and like I was like, wow, it looks better than what I was trying to do. And so I'm always curious to see like, And it's nice to see the way you frame it. It's like, yeah, this was a big mistake, but it led me here. And that's really what this whole journey is about, is this kind of improvement, failing forward, improvement through adversity, stress, failure, whatever it might be.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also being frank to yourself and not criticizing yourself too hard over it. Just like, there'll be another chance to prove them wrong, to show different. So it's like, you need to have faith in, and then I think, and then also, because when I look at murals, for instance, and I think maybe one or two in five, actually, I'm actually happy with, and the other three is, yeah, I learned while making it, and like these lessons, these learnings, you want to incorporate and then take with you to the next one. Yeah.
That's all you have to do.
Yeah.
All I want to do, first, I want to say thank you. This has been super interesting. Now that I know more about like your work, and we're done with the hour already, by the way, that's how fast this goes.
Cool.
So we're, as we come to the end, just a thank you, because now I know even more about your work. I'm going to follow it even closer, and I'm going to start digging. I'm going to see if I can dig through the internet and find some duct tape work that's floating out there somewhere. Before we go, how do people find you? Your social channels, your gallery, your website. Tell everybody how to find you.
Okay, jochemrotteveel.com. I'm sure you're never going to be able to reproduce that on your typeboard. So yeah, that's jochemrotteveel.com. Okay. Also on Instagram, the gallery in Amsterdam is called Gallery Bart. And there's my work included as well. And if you're ever in Rotterdam or in the Netherlands for that matter, just slide a DM and I'll get to offer you coffee. So
that's awesome. Just slip. So you heard that here first, everybody. Just slide into his DMs and you can get a studio visit. But remember, you're not going to be able to get any work there. So just keep Hey, Al, thank you so much for an amazing interview. And I can't wait to keep following the progress and seeing what you have in store for us. Actually, one last thing before you go. Do you have any big shows or anything coming up that we should be aware of, that we should look for?
If you're in Mallorca, which is like an island from the coast of Spain, I'll be there between December 1 and December 12 or so, doing a show there. And then next year, hopefully somewhere in the east of Germany, but that's not really done yet. Yeah. So Mallorca is the first stop.
I actually spent several weeks in the summer in Mallorca this summer.
No way. Yeah. That's so cool.
I love it. It's absolutely fabulous. Okay. Once again, thank you very much. And everybody, keep your eyes out.
Thank you so much.
Okay, stop.